Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Ottawa-born Jamie Fine is a singer and songwriter and an artist that is smart, talented, hilarious, and most of all, honest. She's a kind of dynamic presence who inspires the rest of us to be a little bit louder, a tad more fearless, and just better all round. As a kid, Jamie gravitated towards music, and then after school, she opted to attend culinary school instead of university and launched her own catering business upon graduating. Following a creative awakening, she chose to quit the business and pursue music full-time in 2017. She reached platinum heights in the duo Elijah Woods and Jamie Fine, scoring a series of smashes in Canada. 2020 saw her step out solo and craft a signature style of her own. She has reintroduced herself in a series of singles, including If Anything's Left, with 24.4 million global streams, platinum in South Africa, number 8 at Top 40 and main adult contemporary at Canadian Radio, and her debut EP for Universal Music Canada. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Jamie Fine. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I am at home in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and I'm doing great. I'm going to get my hair dyed in about 30 minutes so I can look good for all y'all South Africans, but I'll... for right now, we're starting to pack and get ready to leave.
I've been to Toronto, and I remember at the time my friend said to me, I'm only allowed to come in June, July, or August because the rest of the year, the weather is rubbish.
1,000%. And in June, but you guys have humidity too, I think. So Canada's, or at least on the east side, is quite humid. And so we are desperate for warm weather by the time June rolls around, and then we can barely breathe when we walk outside. So you lose some, you lose some.
Okay, Jamie, so now let's start at the very beginning. At what age did you think to yourself, cool, I want to be in the entertainment or music world? And how did that journey progress to where we are currently?
So I'm very fortunate that I knew what I wanted to do since seventh grade. So I was about 11 or 12 years old. And I remember I was like singing in the shower or something, and I got out of the shower, got dressed, went in my room, came out of my room, and my dad was like, I think you can sing, kiddo. And I was like, okay, all right, Ian. Like, and I went to school that day, and I went to my like band teacher, and I just had a conversation with him, and I was like, do you have like a recording equipment? And he's like, yeah, I do. And so he like helped me kind of set it up and understand like the recording aspect of it. And by the time I got to high school, I sat down with my two best friends, both of them named Emily, and I said, I want to do music. And they were like, what do you mean? Like, what does that mean? And I was like, I want to write for other artists. That is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And they were like, good luck. Like, okay, we all knew nothing about it, right? And so, yeah, since then, it was the clearest thing I knew that I was, I'm not entirely admittedly religious, and I'm not very spiritual, but if there's one thing I believe in the world, I was put on this planet to make music.
Okay, so you had this inclination and passion and knowledge of certainty. So how did the next steps develop to when the world started recognizing you?
I think I worked throughout high school to develop who I was as a person. You know, I didn't know who I was when I was a kid, and I was very heavily bullied, and I felt so friggin' lost in the world, and it was my job to find my place in it. And I put that work in throughout high school and built the confidence and got on stage and performed and just figured out who I was as a person. And then by extension, that helped me understand who I was as an artist. And then, you know, after high school, my parents, God bless them, wanted me to, you know, go to university and study something. And I was like, of course, I get it. I know what I want to do. And they were like, you have to go to school and or take a break and do work or do something. And I'm like, I want to do music. And they were like, Jamie, like, come on. And I was like, okay, fine. So I went to culinary school and developed such an equal passion for that, while working my ass off with music. And then when it really switched for me, I graduated high school, culinary school. I worked in the industry for a year or two, and I thought, I'm done. I need to jump in both feet, you know, with both feet with music. And that was in about 2015. And then 2016, 2017, I released kind of my first song with my ex co-artist, and that it kind of clicked right away. And we were very fortunate. We had a great plan of releasing music. And as soon as we started, that's when kind of people started recognizing specifically our home country in Canada. So we were very fortunate that it happened pretty right away. And then we've just been kind of working since.
So you mentioned your co-artist and you're releasing music with that individual. And now you're releasing music as a soloist. So what is the difference for you between releasing as a soloist and then the setup of releasing as a duo or with another person?
You know, it sounds harsher than I think I want it to. I finally get to tell my own story, and I don't need to muffle it to fit anybody else's. I don't need to suppress it to fit anyone else's life or story. My ex Cordis and I, we saw the world very differently. We saw music very differently. We saw life very differently. And I think when I finally went on my own as a solo artist, I was like, oh, this is the way it was always supposed to be. And I had lost myself for a little bit there. I think I had to go through that process. But now as a solo artist, I get to just be me, and it feels incredibly cathartic.
So you referenced that you and your ex-co-collaborator viewed the world in very different ways. So I'm going to dive right into this. So I'm not sure if you're aware of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. And the understanding is that everyone in the world interacts, receives, or processes information differently. And the challenge is that everyone else is assuming that everyone is receiving the information the same as them, which is what's leading to a lot of breakdowns in communication, and most people don't realize this. So NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, people have three sort of processing skills, and what a person is dominant in one, secondary in another, and tertiary in another. So the three skills are either visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. So visual people create pictures of the information that they're receiving. Kinesthetic people, kinesthetic people, they do the interpretation through the energy, the body language, the tone of voice, the emotion. And then auditory people receive words, sentences, and paragraphs, and process the information through the words, sentences, and paragraphs that they are hearing. So focusing specifically on music, when you listen to music by other artists or your own songs, again, only in this aspect of your life, are you seeing pictures? Are you hearing the words, or are you feeling the energy?
So it's beautiful the way that you explain that. So, that what you just explained is something that I had to dive into in therapy, because I couldn't understand who I was. And that's who I am. I do all three. And I think that made me a very different kid. And my parents didn't know how to raise me, because they were like, we don't get it. You don't process information the same way we process information. And I felt so alone in the world. Because I felt I had a great, I pick up on, I'm such an energy person, and I pick up on body language. So I always say to people, like, I don't really care what you're saying to me. I'm watching you, because your words are kind of tertiary to me. Like, that's the third thing I'm looking at. I do all three. And especially when it comes to music, I'm a visual learner, and I'm a visual digester. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to absorbing information in all other ways, I would say, it's a very equal balance of all three. And that's what made me kind of different.
I can't wait to meet you and just hang out. We are the same. So I did a course a few years ago, and they tested us on this, specifically the visual, auditory, kinesthetic. The test had 150 questions. And generally and normally, a person would get like 100 or 110 for their dominant, and then 20 or 30 or 40 for their secondary, and maybe 5 or 10 for their tertiary. And my results came equally, 50-50-50, which means, like you, I'm equally dominant in all three areas. So what that means is, in the past, I would be interacting with someone and it would be so challenging because I'd been kinesthetic one part of the conversation, then switched to auditory and not understand what was going on. And I'd be like, huh, I don't understand you. But now understanding this, I just flow with energy and let it happen as it does and know that, cool, I'm switching out the different ones, so I need to now interpret in this way. So it's so interesting and so fascinating, this conversation.
It's really interesting, man. And it's, wow, you're just great. But it's so interesting because I also think that learning that and how I was made me a little more patient with other people, right? Because often I would get very overwhelmed or annoyed when other people were trying to communicate with me. And I'm like, what? Can you just say this? But that's not how everyone works, right?
Exactly.
So me understanding how I was helped me process other people's information. And what I realized is that we all kind of owe each other adapting to how each other communicates because no one person is the same. And it was really interesting doing that and how it translated to my music and how, because I write for other artists as well, right? So even getting in sessions and helping other people who I sense are kind of like me in that way and helping them navigate it. It's completely changed my life understanding that information. You're cool, man. Let's just, I'm flying a day early so we can just hang it out.
Looking forward to that. Can't wait to meet you in person. So now let's dive into your creative world and your creative brain. From creating a song, how do you do that? And what is your creative process?
I've really worked my butt off to make sure that I'm not relying on anything as a crutch when I'm writing music and that I want to be able to be as adaptable as possible. There's certain songs, you know, for example, If Anything's Left, that song came out of me in like 20, 25 minutes with the writer that was in the room with me. And it was one of those things that like I had such a sensation of happiness and I wanted to put it into a song. And then you look at a song like Bulletproof, which is about my family and very, very emotional. I needed the writers in the room there to help me manage my emotions so that they can help me get the story out, because I was too overly emotional about it. You know what I mean? And so I think it changes, you know, depending on the song that I'm trying to write, depending on who's in the room with me. If I'm alone, sometimes I need to be completely alone to be able to just get it out. But yeah, sometimes I get pretty overwhelmed with like how I'm feeling about it. And I need somebody to tame that a little bit and say, why don't you say this? Instead of going on like this 14-hour-long therapy session unpacking how I'm feeling about the song, you know? So it's pretty cool. That's what I love about what I do, is being able to, every writing session is such a different experience.
So tell us, what is the difference between writing a song for yourself compared to when you're writing a song for another artist?
It's so interesting because really writing for somebody, they're both psychology sessions. They're both therapy sessions. We start every session talking about our feelings, where we are in life, to decide what we're, you know, going to write about. I think the biggest difference is I get to do that for other people when I'm writing for them. I don't have to worry about how the song's being marketed. I don't have to worry about what the album cover is going to look like. I don't have to worry about the song title. I'm just there to help them tell a story. And it takes a little bit of the pressure off. When I'm writing for myself, I think I have to see the bigger picture. How is this going to, you know, what are some ideas, what are videos that I'm going to post for it or whatever. As I'm writing the song for other artists, I'm just completely focused on helping them tell their story. But all of them, the biggest similarity between everything is that the first hour typically of every session is really me or the other artist just unpacking how they feel so that we can get to, oh, what are we going to write today? Like, what's important to you to write about? And that's what I want to do. I typically don't get in sessions with people who want to write like kind of fluffy stuff. I want to get down to like the bare bones of how you're feeling in life. And that's because that's what I want to contribute to the world with my music, right? With myself and with other people that I'm working with.
When you're collaborating with someone new, a new energy that you haven't collaborated with before, so when you get into the studio, does it take you a moment to get used to that person and energy? Or do you just dive into that hour therapy session and just crack on?
I typically dive right in, and I think I don't want this sounding like it's coming from a place of ego. I think that's why people enjoy being in a session with me. I don't really give a lot of room for people to feel uncomfortable, and that's not because they can't feel uncomfortable. It's the fact that like I want everyone to have the safest space ever to just be able to talk about what they want to talk about. And I do that in such a blunt, abrupt way that people are typically like, oh, okay, let's dive right in. Yeah, they're like, let's dive right in. And then they realize, even the shyest of people realize all of a sudden they've opened up so quickly, right? Yeah. And I think that's my asset in a room where, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, I have to take a little bit of a step back and let them just handle everything. And sometimes they take a little bit more of a direct approach of really navigate or you're steering the session. Yeah. And it's just, I think that's what writers are meant to do. And I think that writers need to perfect that because it's all about making the artist feel as comfortable as they can, right?
That's the same for me. So when I start an interview, it's like, when is your birthday? Where in the world are you? Let's just go. So I like to dive straight in. And then that breaks that wall of the other person or the artist thinking, oh, who's this person? What gossip does he want? What juicy bits does he want? They feel comfortable and we just dive straight into the interview.
But you are so good at that because you as well, you don't leave room for people feeling uncomfortable. And I think that's an asset and it's a very rare asset for people to have that I'm picking up the same quality in you that like you walk into a room and you make everyone feel important. And that's important, right? In a world where so many people are dumbed down a little bit and kind of like just settle down, you make people feel big and that's an asset, you know?
Well, the way I approach it, and a lot of my friends think this is quite funny, but I feel that everyone uses two-ply toilet paper. There's no gold-plated toilet paper, which means that the same way I speak to you, Jamie, I speak to the CEO, I speak to the tea lady, I speak to the checkout counter person. We are all equal. There's no separation between you and me, and that's just the way I think. And in that, we all use two-ply.
Big and right. I think that's a beautiful way of seeing the world. And there is no hierarchy at the end of the day. There really isn't. And I love that, man.
I love Mia CD. I love the journey of the choosing, the unpacking, the looking at the booklet, listening to it from song 1 to 10 or 11 or whatever number. Physical formats, CDs, cassettes, even cassettes and vinyls are making a massive comeback. I'm not sure if you're aware that alone in the UK last year, there were 5.9 million albums sold, the biggest since 1990. But we've also got these digital platforms where people consume music on. What are your observations and perceptions of the music industry landscape at the moment?
Oh, you know, I mean, my label's going to drop me. I struggle as an artist. I think a lot of people are struggling as an artist right now. We're consuming music very quickly. I think there's some beautiful things about it that unfortunately are turning it not so beautiful. I love that we have never had more access to more artists in the world that previously wouldn't have been discovered. I think that's one of the best things about it. But I think we're consuming music too quickly. I think we have too much of an expectation on artists. You know, I'll drop a song and a week later people will be like, when's the next one coming? And I'm like, oh my God, people used to market a single for like a year. And now it's not like that. And even like an album that like we'll work so hard on, we'll market it, we'll drop it. And somebody will be like, oh my God, can't wait for the next project. And it's like, oh man, like, can you just digest this one for a little bit? You know, Justin Timberlake used to release an album and tour 2 years for that album across the world. The world doesn't really have patience for that anymore. And I think that, you know, that's a tough pill for artists like me to swallow for sure. But I think at the end of the day, it's about realistically, it's our job to adapt. You sink or swim. And my job as an artist is how can I cut through the parts that I don't love and make my music last and hit people in a different way. And it's my job as a business person, ultimately, to provide that with my music. And so there's good and there's bad. I'm a vinyl gal. And I love seeing that vinyl is on the way up, as you just said. And I remember going to get CDs when I was a kid, my dad taking me to, you know, HMV or whatever it was called. And I was like, oh my God, like, I can't wait to just like pick out music. You know? And so I miss that really cathartic experience that we've lost a little bit. Scrolling on Spotify isn't really the same thing. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So for the listeners, as we know, the podcast will be available and be accessible forever. So I'm currently speaking to Jamie in April of 2024, and she'll be coming to South Africa in a few days to perform. So Jamie, tell us a little bit more about the upcoming performance.
The last experience, I'm the most me on stage, first and foremost. Performing is what I love to do. The band that I perform with are so incredible. And we have such a connection on stage. When we went to South Africa last year in September, I had never experienced anything like it, truly. And I've been performing for 6-7 years. And I think that all of us are just excited to get back and do it there specifically. We put on a rock show, man. Like, we love just having fun on stage. And we made a pact with each other, myself, Matt, my guitarist, and Darius, my drummer. We made a pact with ourselves a long time ago that whatever the crowd size, whatever they look like, wherever it is, we have fun on stage first. And that's it. And because we've made that pact, it always translates to the crowd, whether there's 5 people in the crowd or 20,000 people in the crowd. It's the same thing. And I think that's what everyone can kind of expect from these next few performances.
I'm so looking forward to it. And I'm going to be standing right up in front cheering you on. So like I said, I'm normally that person that's right up in front cheering you on, doing my thing, dancing and so forth. I'll take my cell phone out for a couple of videos, a couple of photos, and I put it away. I notice the people around me for 80%, even sometimes 90% of the time, they have their cell phones out, videoing, picturing, tweeting, posting, and so forth. From the person on the stage seeing a bunch of phones, do you feel that that takes away from the energy of the moment, or it's just where society is at this time?
It goes back to, you know, the whole streaming thing and everything. Yeah. It's about us, you know, needing to adapt. The reality is, it is the way that it is. I remember an artist, I think it was Miranda Lambert, a few months ago, you know, went online maybe it's not her, don't quote me. But some artist had said, like, everyone, like, put your friggin' phones away. And she got so crapped on after, right? I think what she was trying to achieve was obvious, you know, and it didn't achieve it. And people were really upset with her, saying, like, we bought the ticket, we can do whatever we want at the show.
Yeah.
So I understand that, you know, we're living in a completely different time. Also, a lot of, you know, the newer generations, or generation younger than me, they grew up with a phone in their hand, right? Glued to their hand. And so for them, that is how they absorb experience. It's not how I absorb experience. I'm like you, where, you know, I'll take a picture or so, but then I put my phone away and I just want to, listen to the music. That's why I bought the ticket. But I have to adapt to the way other people absorb me as an artist and the music as an artist. Sometimes it can be overwhelming, but I choose to see it as a beautiful thing. They want to capture the moment. They want to be able to relive it and show their friends or post it online. And that helps me grow as an artist, right?
Yeah.
So I've gotten pretty good at adapting.
I love this game. Now, I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 years, I know your answer will be different every time, simply because there are millions of them. I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite, I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those songs be and by whom?
I love you so much. Fix You, Coldplay. Incomplete, Backstreet Boys. Iris, Goo Goo Dolls.
Mm-hmm.
Dream On, Aerosmith.
Mm-hmm.
And wow.
The last one's normally difficult for most people.
I know. And then all of a sudden I forget every song ever created. I would say it's gotta be like a pop banger of my generation. I feel like it's gotta be like the middle. I don't know if it was big over there in South Africa. I don't know if that was big there.
Who sings it again?
It's, I'm going to look it up right now.
Okay.
It was such a huge rock song in North America, and I don't know the middle by the middle. Jimmy Eat World. Oh, and it's such a banger. And like, I was going to actually talk to the people bringing us out, because we do a cover of a few different artists in one of our songs, but we had said, I tried looking to see if it charted in South Africa, and I couldn't see that it did, but I wondered if it was a big song there, because it's so interesting how the world works, right? A huge song that doesn't necessarily blow up over there, and vice versa. So yeah, we're excited to play that live. But that is just such a it's such a an iconic song for us that every time it turns on, everyone's like, "Oh my God, I'm back in the 2000s. Let's go, baby."
Jamie, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
I just want to thank everybody, you know, not to get too overly emotional, the cancer that I am. You know, as an artist, we want to go international. That's the, you know, we want as many people listening to our music as possible. And as an artist, you know, we live for the applause, and it's unhealthy and it sucks and it's tough on our mental health. We live for the applause. And when people aren't clapping, it's, we're like, what are we doing wrong? What did I do? And when I first started getting the international love, I had never experienced that kind of validation in my life, unhealthy or healthy. I don't know, but it is what it is. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the music and accepting me as an artist and a human being and supporting what I felt like I was put on this planet to do. And you're the reason I, you know, it sounds really trivial. And I know that a lot of artists say this, but you're the reason we keep doing it. Because if you weren't listening and supporting, we would have nothing. And so thank you for just loving me or not loving me. Maybe just liking one song. I'll take it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.